This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, today is a very special day. Actually, this entire week for me is a very special week because this is Napoleon week, and I am so thrilled that I have a Napoleon expert who I am going to chat with, because for me, well, I will tell you that I have been fascinated by Napoleon ever since I was a kid, and I have over 200 books about Napoleon, so I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Owen Pataki. The name of his, well, one of his books is Searchers in Winter, a novel of Napoleon's empire. And with his sister, he also wrote another book, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Hi, Owen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on again. It's nice to speak to you again.
Oh, well, it's a joy to talk to you, a fellow enthusiast. You know, I was just thinking on Tuesday, of course, it was the 14th, so it was the anniversary of the Battle of Marengo, which some people have heard of about it because of the chicken. You know, they've eaten chicken Marengo, and they don't know where it came from. So it's a pretty exciting subject, isn't
it? It is. There's a lot of Napoleon kind of leftovers from his time that have nothing to do with war, that are, you know, the Napoleon pastry and, you know, a million different things that we don't associate necessarily with Napoleon himself. But he definitely left a larger-than-life legacy, that's for sure.
Certainly did. Now, tell us about your fascination with Napoleon, because as I said, I started very young, reading very young, and I was already into French history and also the history. Well, actually, I loved Roman history because I started studying Latin in high school, and I took 4 years of Latin. And so it's sort of all meshed in. When I actually got to Europe and started traveling around Europe, I was either in a battlefield for the Romans or a battlefield for Napoleon.
Yeah. Well, first off, that was a generous intro. Thank you. I definitely would not consider myself an expert on Napoleon, but more of an enthusiast like yourself. And that's interesting that you mentioned that it was the studying the Roman, you know, period that led you into Napoleon, because I have a sort of a similar track to, you know, this Napoleon fascination that actually started with the French Revolution, which was before I ever really had any sort of particular fascination with Napoleon and the Napoleonic Wars. I started in high school I took a course on several revolutions. It was called, you know, Revolutions in Europe or something, and one of them was the French Revolution. We read books and, you know, studied first hand documents, but what really opened my eyes was a film called Danton, starring Gérard Depardieu, about George Danton and Maximilien Robespierre, and it was about the Committee of Public Safety. And it's this good kind of obscure older, I think it was from the 80s, maybe early 90s film that just documents kind of the last days, if you will, of Danton, Robespierre, and the Jacobins, and the more radical revolutionaries during the French Revolution in Paris. And the end of it is this scene where Danton and his kind of his acolytes, his people, get guillotined. And it's like, it was this really kind of intense, graphic scene where I was like, wow, this is really intense. It just kind of grabbed me. I was just so kind of in awe of the French Revolution and how intense it was, and how such a beautiful, you know, quote unquote civilized city like Paris and France could become so barbaric and violent. And I just really kind of wanted to know more about the French Revolution, and that led me into studying that time period, that led, you know, to the story that would become Where the Light Falls. And so that period grabbed me, and then as I was, you know, researching for that book, that period transitions, as you well know, into the Napoleonic era. As first consul, he, you know, he's his coup d'etat. He becomes first consul, eventually crowns himself emperor, and the rest is history. So literally, so that was kind of how I transitioned into this fascination with Napoleon, was the French Revolution.
Well, and of course, Where the Light Falls, which is the novel about the French Revolution, you wrote with your sister, New York Times bestselling author herself, and I love that book.
Thank you. Yeah. Ali and I co-wrote it. It came out in 2017, and it was a very interesting collaboration between, as you mentioned, a bestseller, my sister Allison, who had previously published three books before that. So it was actually her idea to collaborate. I had this idea that was kind of the germ of Where the Light Falls, the story, the plot, the characters. And I saw it kind of as a movie, or maybe, you know, a limited series or something. Someday I could see kind of visually. And I kind of pitched the idea to my sister Allison, and she was like, "Oh yeah, I like that. You should write a book." And I was like, "Oh, I'd never really thought about writing books before then." And she, you know, she had the experience, so she's like, "Hey, why not try writing it together, that we could both contribute?" And over the next few years, I was still in the army at the time, so we would do these long distance phone calls, like over lunch or on weekends, talking about the characters, and eventually, as we were writing the document, we were literally going through scene by scene, chapter by chapter, long distance phone calls, at least at the beginning of the process. So it was definitely an unorthodox approach. It was unique and different, but it was we're happy with how it ended up.
Well, it's an excellent book. I just love it. And as I was saying, you know, now as we get into this week, which is a really fascinating week when we think of the Battle of Marengo, and then today is the Battle of Ligny, which was his last victory, because then on the 18th we have Waterloo.
Yeah, no, that's a big week, and I'm glad you reminded me, because to be honest, I hadn't even thought of that. Like, it totally slipped my mind, and I remember the 200th anniversary of Waterloo a couple of years ago, back in 2015. That was a huge event, that with reenactors and you know, cavalry and cannons being shot on the grounds of Waterloo, the battlefield site that I know you've been to. So it's definitely, for history buffs like us, it's definitely an interesting time. And the 100 days of Napoleon's return from exile is tailor made for drama. You know, it really is. It's history, but you study it, you read it, and it really feels like some sort of epic drama playing out.
Well, I was so emotional the first time that I got to Waterloo, because I had read so much about it. By that point, I had already, I think, had perhaps 100 books about Napoleon and Wellington. So I could literally walk the battlefield. And I was newly married, and my husband didn't know much about Napoleon. And I'm walking, and I'm telling him where all the, you know, here's this one standing here, this one standing here. And he was amazed. I think he was really impressed, you know, because we got married rather quickly. He didn't know all of this about me. I was like, who did I marry? I didn't know somebody could. So he was pretty surprised.
Well, that's not your standard honeymoon, but if you like it, you love it, and that was good of him to be a good sport about that. Hopefully he enjoyed it too.
Oh, he was a good sport, because we eventually landed up. We visited 28 or 29 battlefields, of Napoleon's battlefields over the years, from Italy to Austria, of course, and even into. I went to Russia. He couldn't go to Russia. He was Israeli, and at the time, it wasn't safe. It wasn't safe for him to go into Russia. But so, you know, I've been to 28 or 29 of these battlefields. So it's part of, you know, my fascination with Napoleon. But it's not just his fighting. There's so much more to the man.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll say that you sound, I think you might be the expert here, so I feel like I should be asking you and interviewing you for your expertise, but that's 28 battlefield visits is putting me to shame, so I gotta get to work on getting to some of those sites. But no, that's definitely true. And it's not just his fighting, but it's also not just him as emperor. I mean, that's kind of his his epic crowning achievement was you know, literally taking the crown from the Pope's hands and putting it on his head, and then Battle of Austerlitz and his, you know, epic rise and fall and the invasion of Russia. It's all really very fascinating, but I also was really fascinated with his kind of rise to power, you know, the context, his background. He was a Corsican. You know, he didn't come from the traditional French nobility. How the French Revolution and, like, the social upheavals of that time period, like, kind of catapulted him, or at least put him into these circumstances, like the attempted coup d'etat in Paris that he put down, the siege of Toulon, where he was a 23-year-old, 24-year-old captain, and 6 months later he'd become a brigadier general who was in charge of armies, in just a span of a few months. And so, yeah, his whole life is just really, really dramatic and interesting. And yeah, you don't have to be like a war junkie to be fascinated with the time period and with Napoleon and his story. There's something in there for anyone who likes history or likes good drama.
One of the things that I've always found fascinating is how very intelligent he was. I mean, he had an amazing memory. I think we can compare him to Churchill. They both had these amazing memories where they could remember so much. And in my case, I'm a little bit like that. I remember, I have this ability to like visualize a page in a book that I've read sometimes like 30 years ago. And I can see the book, I can see the page in my head. So it's funny. I'm thinking about something. And I can walk over to my bookshelf, at one of my many bookshelves, and pick up a book, and I know exactly what page to go to. But not in the way that they did. They learned passages of poetry, passages from books, and they could, you know, recite these. Napoleon was so brilliant at a very young age. By the time he was 12 years old, he was already finished with trigonometry. So it's fascinating to really get into him, his life, and what he did.
Yeah, he was definitely a full-on genius. And an interesting story is that, as you mentioned, how smart he was. He was a prodigious child. He was kind of, you know, the gifted kid who was always ahead of the class. And one of his military instructors, I believe it wasn't Saint Cyr. I got to look it up, but I'll find it. But at his military school, one of his instructors was talking about this young Bonaparte and said he scared me. Like, he always scared me, because not only was he the most gifted, the most intelligent, but he knew it. Napoleon definitely knew it, and he kind of always felt like he was destined, or at least capable of great things, and that kind of led to, I think, how effective he was at, like, you know, actually implementing his ambitions. Was that he had this hyper intelligence, kind of like a chess master, like you think of a chess genius who's just always thinking several steps ahead, who doesn't take long to make decisions, and who really just has an instinctive grasp of strategy and of tactics and of decision making in quick time. And you know, like we talked about, the world kind of world events unfolded that like threw open the doors for someone with his intelligence. And he was an artillery officer, so the trigonometry, the mathematics you mentioned, was something he implemented with ruthless efficiency. I mean, he was the perfect man to be in charge of a battery of cannons against, you know, an enemy position, because he understood the physics of it. He understood the capabilities and the limitations, and then, you know, the logistics of just moving hundreds of thousands of men and weapons and equipment across countries. You know, that logistics is mind-boggling. But Napoleon was a genius, so he was the one who was kind of always capable of pulling, you know, making the most complex things in the world seem relatively simple. So that's for sure.
Well, and he had it all in his head. He didn't have all these PowerPoint displays that,
right,
you know, that
smart.
That
he didn't have a smartphone.
Yeah, that our military, I think if you took away the PowerPoint displays nowadays, they would like collapse. I would just love to do that. You know, go to the Pentagon and take away all their PowerPoint displays, and see how long they would last. Not long.
You still learn about Napoleon in modern day armor. My brother was an artillery officer in the Marines, and I mean, we touched that. I wasn't in the artillery, but you still learn a little bit about Napoleon. I think it was him who coined the term "King of Battle." Artillery.
Oh yeah,
and he's the most famous artilleryman in history, and yeah, he definitely, you know, I won't go too into the weeds of it, but like his structure of how he organized his staff and his different, you know, of intelligence and logistics and transportation and signaling, all those different, you know, facets of an army and moving an army is still used today by the United States military. The way his organization of staff and structure and how you organize an army with, like we said, all these complicated different movements and organizations and personnel, that's still used, basically the structure that Napoleon set up during the Napoleonic War. So for sure, he was ahead of his time. And yeah, we're still kind of learning lessons from him today.
So when you started your book about Napoleon, what was your research like? Where did you travel to places? What did you do when you were writing?
So the first book was a little different because, like I said, it was collaborative, and that was a long time coming. I had the idea basically from high school, the story I told you about watching that movie and studying the French Revolution, and over a decade, I kind of always came back to it. And so the research was a long process of just kind of trying to assimilate the French Revolution, and what I say is, like, I do kind of two kind of researches, you know, or modes of research when I'm working on a book. Is the first one's kind of broad, when you have a specific, or you have a time period, you have a setting, you have, you know, a Napoleon or someone, and you do kind of broad research on that individual, or, you know, the time period, just so you have the context of what people would be talking about, what life was like, what the day-to-day would be like, what the major events or personalities would be impacting people's lives. And that's broad, and that's kind of in you know, preparation and while you're brainstorming and you know, outlining and structuring your story, you're doing this broad research. And then as you get into the writing itself, I like to do a little more kind of measure, like specific research tailored to a specific event or a specific battle or a certain person who's maybe has an important scene in a book, and then I'll kind of tailor that down and focus specifically on one particular subject, and that's more of a targeted research that's closer to when I'm actually writing the book. So it's broad, but it's also very specific, and I mean, as you know, you can get lost. If you're interested in this kind of stuff, you can get lost in it, and you can, if anything, you have to kind of limit yourself because you can't read everything and you can't learn everything. So you have to pick and choose which books you want to read, what you want to focus on, and then, you know, go from there.
Now, when one of the things I think there are so many misconceptions about Napoleon, and really most people don't know more than a little bit about the sex side of his life, the Josephine side. They don't really understand too much about what he was into, really, of the ideas he had for changing the system, for codifying laws, for example. He had such detailed ideas on how to, well, he was looking at ways to improve the country.
Yeah. I mean, he came out of the chaos and the anarchy and the violence of the French Revolution. So he was, as we know, like, he was a tyrant and a dictator. So he was very much a heavy-handed leader who wanted, you know, law and order. He wanted control. He didn't want mass demonstrations and bloody battles in the streets of Paris. So he was very much an authoritarian in that respect. But like you said, he was also an innovator. He was, you know, public works, new broad avenues like Rue de Rivoli in Paris, which is still one of the main, you know, thoroughfares in Paris, was constructed during Napoleon. L'Arc de Triomphe, the giant monument at the end of Champs-Élysées, started under Napoleon to commemorate his army. He built a lot, you know, the the concept that we still use of alternate street numbers, odds and evens on opposite sides of the street. That was, again, that was started by in Napoleon's era. He built bridges. You know, he gave money to the arts. He facilitated the arts and created a system of private high schools that, again, I think is still generally around today in France. So, and like you said, the Code Napoleon, the Napoleonic Code of the law code that was at least, you know, written in by his lawyers and at his request is still mainly French law today. So he definitely was a reformer, and absolutely a visionary. So I mean the scale and the carnage of his wars definitely kind of obscures the more positive civic minded innovations and developments that he had during his life, because, you know, it was all well and good, but when you lose 500,000 dead men in Russia, you kind of negate all the good you've done back home. And the, you know, when you're, so many people are dying and suffering in war, it kind of, it that definitely minimizes your civil republican contributions in Napoleon's case.
Oh yes, you know, when you are interested in Napoleon, you always, there's part of you that always goes back and says, why Russia? Why?
Yeah.
Why,
yeah.
Russia? Of all places, I don't want it myself. I wouldn't want it. I don't know why he wanted it. I always go back to that, and, you know, like if I could go back in a point in time, I'd go back there and say, no, leave Russia alone. They're not worth it. But
that definitely didn't work out for him.
It didn't work out, and it was tragic. You know, the whole, well, who would believe, you know, we were at a point here where we thought Europe was finished with wars between themselves. I mean, at that time, of course, you know, back then, all of the different countries were warring. Italy was a mess. They had so many little countries within Italy. They were all fighting. The Austrians were fighting. The Germans were fighting. The Prussians were fighting. Everybody was fighting. I understand, from one point of view, he wanted to unite everybody and stop the fighting, but going around killing everybody to stop the fighting sort of didn't work out.
Yeah. Well, back then, definitely war was just the way they solved political issues. That was just kind of par for the course. It had been throughout, like, you know, all of European history. So that definitely is true compared to today, and it of course.
Well, compared to today, I mean, who would have believed it's 2022 that we would have a war in Ukraine? Because I remember when I was studying Franz Joseph and how Franz Joseph was trying to unite the countries around, you know, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, how he was trying to unite them so they wouldn't fight with each other, so that they would just already stop fighting. And now the Ukraine, can you believe it?
It's a really, really, really sad, tragic, horrific development, what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. Like, we all thought after World War II, the European continent,
safe,
a few minor exceptions of, like, the Balkans or something, was just kind of a post-war continent.
No, and I didn't even worry about the Balkans, because I figured, what the heck, nobody's going to bother them, they're not worth it. And the worst thing we thought always was, of course, terrorism, outside terrorism coming in to Europe. So we thought Europe was safe. We thought we could, you know, travel, you know, safely. But who knows? If Russia can go against Ukraine, I don't know. Maybe the Prussians are going to rise up again. you don't know. It's really sort of insane when you think about it.
It really is. Insane is probably the best word to describe what's happening in Ukraine right now. I mean, not to get too political with it. I know that's not...
No, I'm not political. I don't want to be political. I'm talking about just the historical idea of having wars in Europe.
Absolutely. And one thought I did have was when Russia invaded Ukraine and you're seeing what's happening, it seemed reminiscent to me a little bit of Napoleon invading Russia, where you're like, wow. That is an extraordinarily bold, aggressive move that most sober-minded, or Germany invading Russia in World War II. It's such biting off such a big chunk in such a bald-faced, aggressive move that you you know, when Napoleon did invade Russia, his marshals, men who swore allegiance to him, who died for him, they all, almost all, questioned him and personally asked him, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure about this? It's not too late to turn back or to reconsider. And watching what Russia is doing in Ukraine now, I think most sober-minded people around the, you know, the developed world are looking at Putin's move and thinking, are you sure about this? Like, is this really in your best interest? Are you, like, is this the best thing for your people, or is this your ego and your aggressiveness getting the better of you? So I definitely did think of Napoleon. That's how my weird history mind works. But I thought about Napoleon invading Russia when I heard about Russia actually was going to invade Ukraine. I thought, man, this is bold. There's going to be a lot of human suffering, and I'm not sure this isn't going to be the step towards the beginning of the end for you, as it was for Napoleon, as it was for Hitler when he invaded Russia. It just seems like a biting off way more than you could ever chew.
Well, and the Ukraine was part of Napoleon's plan too. I mean, it's right there, you know, between him and Russia, and so it was all involved. And it's really fascinating when we look at it and we think. We always talk about learning from history, but boy, oh boy, we've got some more lessons to learn.
Yeah, and I always think that, like, things don't just happen in a vacuum. Things are you know, the World War One and the aftermath, the peace led to the rise of fascism, and that led to World War Two. World War Two led to the Cold War collapsing has largely led to Putin. And that goes back way before World War One. The European powers' colonialism and the rivalries, and that, you know, the Franco-Prussian War. But that came from the aggression that the Germans had as they were kind of becoming a nation from Napoleon, who kind of walked all over the Prussians at Jena, the university, sleepy little small German town that was a site of one of Napoleon's most famous victories. And that like galvanized college students. That they say that was kind of the birth of modern German nationalism that led to, you know, Otto von Bismarck and Clausewitz and Goethe and all these Germans that kind of put momentum behind the idea of a modern, powerful German state, which obviously would lead to World War One and World War Two and et cetera. And Napoleon was largely, at least, the main catalyst for that particular, you know, spread of German, what would become German nationalism. So it's not really a stretch to go back in history. You see the cause and effect, like these dominoes falling, and Napoleon. I almost think of the Napoleonic Wars as like the First World War, because it was it wasn't modern technology like in the 21st century. But it was modern ideas. It was a republic versus monarchy. It was like the American Revolution versus...
Well, I think that's a good take on it, actually. Now, Owen, I have to take a commercial break. But when I come back, I would like to talk more about Elba, about the Rosetta Stone. We didn't get to mention that. And also about his exile, finally, to St. Helena. Okay?
Sure.
So just hold on, and we're going to have some commercials, and then we'll be right back.
All right.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727 353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my very special guest, Owen Pataki, the author of Searchers in Winter, a novel of Napoleon's empire, and we're talking about Napoleon today, all things Napoleon. And while we had the commercial break, I just wanted to check. I wasn't sure about my memory, but I discovered, as I had a vague recollection, that 22 of Ukrainian Cossacks regiments joined Napoleon as they invaded Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the connection is there. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about some more about Napoleon. Tell us about the Elba event.
Well, so his exile
What happened to him?
So he lost the 6 days campaign. So Russia was a disaster. We talked about that. And then for another year, he fights these bloody epic battles in what's now Germany and Prussia, and he's pushed out of Germany. And then fights this brilliant campaign in France, and eventually he's pushed back to Paris, and all his marshals basically say, you have to abdicate. The war is over. The war is lost. And he drinks poison and tries to kill himself, and it doesn't work. He survives. He just has a kind of crazy, trippy night, half dead, half alive, and then in the morning is still alive and is forced to sign a peace of surrender, basically an abdication to the Allies, to the Russians and the Prussians and Austrians. And then so he's banished to Elba, which is an island in the northern Mediterranean, kind of near Corsica, where he was from. And he's there, and he's just kind of this genius, banished genius who's bored, and just, you know, asking for news about France. And I think the French people were happy to be rid of Napoleon for a little while, to not have war, you know, to not have more conscripts going to die, to not be invading Spain or Russia or you know, just constantly fighting. But pretty quickly, the French, you know, the political chaos and divisions in that country start to kind of unravel society, and people are a little bit, there's, you know, the people who have been fighting in the Vendée in the West and basically insurgents against the Republicans and the Bonapartists are now in charge of the country. So there's a lot of kind of settling of scores, and it's just a complete political, like, 180 upheaval, not to mention the Russians are occupying their cities and everything. That's where the term bistro, people think bistro is a French word for restaurant, but bistro, I think, means something like Russian word for faster, like hurry up, hurry up. And that's, they would say bistro in the French cafes to bring their food or their booze faster. So that's a little fun fact there. But so, yeah, the French society was kind of in a free fall after Napoleon was gone. And a year later, he escapes and makes his return to France.
Now, in your book, in the book when you wrote Searchers in Winter. It starts in 1806. Tell my listeners a little bit about what the book is about and the storyline.
Yeah, so the characters who survive Where the Light Falls, which is, again, set during the French Revolution, they're now, the, you know, 7 years have passed, and they're now in 1806. And the three main characters, one is now an officer once again, who's with the Napoleonic army in Prussia, which is about to, you know, have a, you know, Napoleon's successful campaigns across Prussia. Another character, who was a lawyer during the French Revolution and one of the Republicans, returns to Paris and is quickly kind of throws himself into the imperial politics, and kind of unbeknownst to him, you know, things have really changed from the days of the French Revolution, which were probably more bloody in France, but they were, you know, they were less decadent, they were less kind of, you know, imperial cloak and dagger type scheming is now what Paris is like, as opposed to this chaotic, violent, bloody revolutionary turmoil. So he's now, you know, in a different context, where he starts working with Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's older brother, who's highly respected by Napoleon, and he gets involved in these kind of imperial schemes and machinations, and comes afoul of Joseph Boucher, who was Napoleon's early police minister, who was, they said, Boucher was the only man alive who Napoleon was actually frightened of, because he was basically better at, you know, Napoleon stuff than Napoleon was, at least behind closed doors, behind the scenes, not on the battlefield, but in terms of scheming and maneuvering, he outlasted everyone, from the French Revolution, the Reign of Terror, Napoleon, to King Louis XVIII. So that is an antagonist to one of the characters. And then Sophie, who's Andre's wife now in the second book, is at home in Normandy at their estate, and you start to see nobility returning from England, returning from, you know, the German states, because Napoleon allowed them back in. And at the same time, you're seeing war refugees from the Vendée and from Brittany, where there had been these rebellions against the French Revolutionary Republic and Napoleon too. And they start coming onto her estate, and, you know, that's a topical issue, where, you know, refugees fleeing war, fleeing economic disillusionment, that's something Europe and America, of course, are dealing with today. So again, it's similar, you know, it's different, but it's also very similar to what people dealt with back then and what we're dealing with today. So, and then as the story unfolds, the Andre, the character in Prussia who's with the army, he comes across this plan to find this large hidden cache of wealth, of basically hidden treasure, this hidden fortune from a German prince who is fleeing Napoleon's advance across, you know, Germany, Prussia. And Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who was the founder of the Rothschild banking family dynasty, is responsible as his right-hand man, basically his financial advisor, the Prince of Hesse Castle, and they have to flee and bring that fortune to England, to London, where it'll be safe, you know, ostensibly from Napoleon. And that's all true. There's some mythology to it, and of course, you know, in the book we kind of embellish the sort of treasure hunt plot, but at the same time it is based on a real circumstance where this prince was fleeing from Napoleon, and Rothschild really facilitated his, you know, financial rescue to get away from Napoleon and to get safely back to London. And then Rothschild and his son, I mean, he had multiple sons, and he sent them to, you know, later on, it's a different story, he sent them to Paris and to Frankfurt and to Rome, I think maybe Vienna, but that the origin of the Rothschild banking dynasty really does start in 1806 with Napoleon's conquering of Prussia, and it's really fascinating, and so that's one of the plot threads of this book, is this Andre, the character, is, you know, squaring off against another nefarious French hussar officer who wants to get his hands on this fortune and deliver it to Napoleon, and use that as a kind of a power play to, you know, embellish his, you know, enhance his own career prospects, maybe become a marshal, maybe become, you know, a governor of a European city or state. So that's a fictional plot that we that is kind of the heart of the story, but it is based in reality and in true events.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I think it's a great way to sort of get into Napoleon for all of my listeners out there. If they want to, you know, look for a book to start with, I think this is a great book. If you don't know much about Napoleon, it will draw you in, and it's a fascinating period of time. And then there's so much more. As I said, for me, so much of my traveling in Europe was... I always think that when you're traveling, when you have a hobby, when you have something that interests you, when you have a fascination with something, it makes your life so much better. It enriches you because I don't care what, you know, if you're like nowadays people are looking at their family trees and they're trying to find out where they came from. I think it's so wonderful when you have this idea of going to the places that, well, perhaps people that you're interested in history or your family, because you're going with a special purpose, and it really makes the entire trip, I think, so much more fun.
Well, first off, thank you for the kind words about the book. That's much appreciated. But yeah, absolutely. It's traveling, especially in Europe. I mean, who doesn't like to travel across Europe? Of course, it's you know, charming and beautiful in its own right, even if you don't care anything about history. But yeah, for those of us who are fascinated by the history, that opens up a whole different dimension to travel. Like it just gives you a different perspective, along with the great wine and beer and food and cuisine and the scenic sites. But yeah, I was very lucky to... I got to stay in Paris, actually, for 2 months when I was researching and writing Searchers in Winter. My grandmother was from France. She's French, and she married an American army officer during World War II, one of those kind of like romantic love stories. And that's my mom's mother. And so that's kind of where the French angle kind of came into our family. But so anyway, I have cousins that live in Paris and around France. So I was lucky enough that they had a spare bedroom in the 12th arrondissement in Paris and lived there for a few months while I was researching. And yeah, I was kind of like, man, I can't believe this is my work. I'm getting away with this. I'm living in Paris. But you know, you're researching, you're walking around to the different locations, and it informs your writing when you can like see, you can feel the distance between this bridge and that bridge, or how long it would take to walk from, you know, Notre Dame to wherever. So it definitely was a like a blessing to get to do that in Paris. And yeah, hopefully I'll have more excuses to travel like that for research in the future.
Yeah, and hopefully we can all start traveling again because a couple of terrible years here. But yeah. I also discovered whenever I went, you know, outside of Paris or outside of Rome, and we were traveling the countryside. By the way, we had a white Cadillac. We had a white Cadillac in Europe. So you can imagine we caused quite a sensation wherever we went. We were driving.
Traveling in style?
Yeah, traveling in style. And, you know, we'd go to these villages. So wherever, like, we went to Normandy quite often because my father had been in D-Day.
Oh, wow.
But whenever you go to these places, if you show an interest in the history or, like, if you go to a outdoor restaurant in, you know, some village, and you're sitting there and you say, well, by the way, did Napoleon ever pass through here? It's amazing how quickly you draw a crowd around you, people who want to talk about it. You know, well, no, he wasn't here, but he was in my great-grandmother's village. And, you know, and people who still have mementos. And it opens up a whole new world. Instead of just being a tourist, looking at pictures and taking pictures and not, you know, getting involved, if you have an interest in any historical character, it really makes traveling so much more fun.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And one thing about Europe that's very nice is they have so much history. You know, you go to London and, like, you know, go to the Tower of London, or you go to Paris or wherever, and there's just literally hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of years more of history that they can share than America. The current United States of America is very young compared to those countries, so there's so much to see. So I think there's a little bit probably you know, maybe not with everybody, but there's a little bit more of a kind of appreciation of history just because there's so much more to look at, like the castles in Ireland or in England or chateau in France. You know, we just don't have the luxury of that much like history on our soil, at least not like in our current country. So in Europe, you can see a building that's 1,000 years old and people know exactly how and where it was built, or, you know, Notre Dame Cathedral or Chartres or something is thousands of years old and it's still standing. The people kind of appreciate that, or at least a lot of people do.
Oh, they do. They really do. I've had some wonderful, wonderful, as a matter of fact, I made a very good friend. One of the things that I always do when I was traveling, I would always go to the library. I always go to the libraries. I always like to check out their libraries. And I went to a library in Graz in Austria, and I mentioned, you know, that I was sort of on the trail of Napoleon, and I met a woman there. And next thing I know, she invites us over to her home for afternoon coffee. Brings out mementos from, her family was on the Austrian side fighting, you know, against Napoleon, and they had all sorts of things, you know, all sorts of memorabilia, and she's telling these stories about her family, and we're in her beautiful home in Graz in Austria, really unbelievable. And you know, all I did was mention Napoleon. It was fascinating.
Yeah, like the amount of just kind of hit you, just unturn a rock, so to speak, and there's a ton of things you never would have expected, like in any town or with a family or something. So, no, that's interesting. I've had a couple of times like that where I've talked to someone, and they're like, oh yeah, we have a painting of our great ancestor who fought against the French revolutionaries, and in painting in his white gear that was, you know, the royalists fighting against the revolutionaries in blue. And it's a painting from almost 300 years ago. And it's
wonderful. It's wonderful. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Owen, for being on Joy on Paper today. It's an absolute joy to speak to you about Napoleon and about, are you working on something new? Are we going to have a new release date for something soon?
Yeah, I'm trying. But let me first say that I appreciate that, Patsy. And same to you. I hadn't realized how much of a Napoleon history enthusiast you were. So I need to learn more from you, because you've been to 28 battlefields. That's 28 more than I've been to in Europe. So that's pretty impressive. So it's all likewise. It's a pleasure to be on and to speak with you and share a mutual enthusiasm. So the answer is yes. I'm working on a third book now. It's actually, I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that it's a third book in this series. And it's actually set in New Orleans in later 1814, early 1815, during the battle of, or, you know, building up to the Battle of New Orleans. And there are characters from the second book that are in it, and it's maybe an offshoot, I guess you could say. And it's the city of New Orleans back then was very French, you know, half the city at least, white. Citizens, black citizens, free enslaved, spoke French, and it was culturally, there were a lot of emigres from Haiti, with Saint-Domingue, which was a French colony that had a successful slave uprising, and a lot of people, white and black, fled to New Orleans, and there was, you know, the history is very unique in that city. I won't go into that, but the book is set in that time period with one of the characters from Sergius and Winter, and it's a little bit different because it's on American soil, but that's exciting. But it still has that French thread because it's the character coming over to New Orleans. And, you know, I won't give away the plot, but that's the context. So
well,
I'm excited.
I look forward to that. You have to make sure that you send me the release date so you'll be on the program. Do you have a website, meanwhile, that you want people to go to?
Well, yes. Yeah, so you can get information about both these books. I think the best way to probably do it is to just go on Amazon and look for Searchers in Winter, to go on Amazon, look for Where the Light Falls. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn. So any social media platform is good to connect with me, or, you know, Facebook, Owen Pataki, I have an author page.
Okay.
Where you can find links to the books and some videos we shot and some information. So I think Facebook might be the best outlet.
Okay, well, thank you, Owen, and say hello to Allison. I've already sent her message inviting her to be on here in September so we can talk about Empress Elizabeth of Austria, because she loves the, she's written a great book about her, and we'll have her here in September, okay?
Yeah, she told me she's looking forward to coming on, so I'll give her your best.
Okay, thank you. Thank both of you. I love history, and I so love to encourage my listeners to just go into history, and you will. It just expands your horizons. It expands your life. So again, Owen Pataki, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thanks so much, Patsy. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye now. Wow. Oh, he's nice. He's a nice guy, and his sister is delightful, and I am so looking forward to talking to her in September. So this has been a really good day because, as I said, on the 18th is the anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, and I always actually, because the 14th was the Battle of Marengo, on the Battle of Waterloo Day, I always make chicken Marengo. There are quite a few recipes online, and you can get it. And the whole story is that when the Battle of Marengo finished, Napoleon was hungry, and his chef went running around the battlefield, found a chicken, and found a few other ingredients, and quickly made up a dish that was fit for a general, for an emperor, and that's where we get chicken Marengo from. And there used to be a wonderful restaurant in Washington, D.C., where they made, although I had chicken Marengo whenever I went to Paris, there was a restaurant in Washington, D.C. that made the best chicken Marengo. And, or maybe I might make the best one. Actually, I think I do. Nowadays, I don't think you can find it anyplace else. But it is wonderful. And you can check out, maybe I'll put the recipe on my webpage. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this recipe for my chicken Marengo on my webpage, which is radio-joyonpaper. So on the 18th of June, which, by the way, is also my son's birthday. Now, I'm not saying that I held out to make sure that he was born on the 18th. But, I really wanted him to be born on the 18th. And so he was born on the 18th. And so, it's just because it's a special day in my life. Okay, everybody. Oh, it was wonderful to talk to Owen Pataki today. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. So get busy and start writing and say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he saluted me, and I saluted him because, I would have been a general. I meant, I could have become an empress. Who knows? I'm a bossy person. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day. Oh, and wonderful weekend. And stay cool. Bye-bye now.